another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 4, The Higg Boson. So what did you do last week?
I always go first. You go first. What did you do last week?
All right. Actually, I wound up doing a lot of things. Well, one of the things I did was I discovered that my impromptu guest paneling on the unofficial Apple weblog TokCast went live. That was a lot of fun. At Verso, Kelly asked if I wanted to be on the panel. I said, sure, why not? I tried to actually voice over IP into their system. They use TalkShoe, which is kind of a neat system, and I've got to look into that because I think it's pretty cool. Unfortunately, it wasn't working properly, so I wound up literally phoning it in. so my audio quality was not great, but I had such a fun time with them. You know, she's really cool. The entire crowd there was really cool. So that was kind of fun. Also, I went on holiday. I went to San Francisco for a week. That was lovely. A couple of weird things happened while I was out there. One, I was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Not for any sort of scandal.
But bees are on the what now?
Yeah. So, I got interviewed by the tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal. My boss emailed me saying, hey, this woman from Wall Street Journal, she wants to interview you or she wants to get a hold of you. You know, this is her contact information. When I got that, I immediately started freaking out. I'm like, okay, what did I do? This could be bad. But also, I've been talking about Apple, you know, ceding the high-end creative area to, you know, what is ostensibly a vacuum. And so I thought, well, maybe she wants to talk about Apple and that sort of thing. And as it turns out, she wanted to talk about T-shirts, Apple T-shirts. And I don't know how she found out that I've got a whole bunch of Apple T-shirts, but apparently she did. And
a whole bunch?
Yeah, I've got over a dozen of them. I also have shirts that I shouldn't own. Those are like I
well,
have,
we all do.
Well, yes, I have. There is that. I've got uniform shirts from the Apple Store employees that I'm under strict orders never to wear. For, you know, obvious reasons. You know, if I pop into an Apple store, it'll be like dressing up like a policeman. It's just, you know, it's false advertising. But I also have some rare ones too. I've got an Open Dock t-shirt, and I also have the t-shirt that's called, or dubbed, I suppose, Been There, Done That. That one's so old that it uses, well, actually the Open Dock one does as well. It uses the old Apple Garamond font. And on the back of it, it lists a whole bunch of Apple technologies, some of which are still in use, like QuickTime and all that sort of thing. But a lot of some of the technologies didn't really make it. Like OpenDoc, for example. But also at the very end of the line, it said, "And Copeland on the way." And yeah. What else did I do? Oh, the other thing I did in San Francisco was I wound up having a beer with our mutual friend John Foster, and wound up closing the 21st Amendment. We actually had a really great time talking about a variety of subjects. I didn't realize that he sailed and worked on a boat, and so we were talking about racing boats and such, and it was really quite fascinating. Thanks, John. You know, if you're ever in New York, definitely let me know. If not, I'll track you down next time I'm out in San Francisco, and we'll close another bar. That was fantastic. Consequently, the following day, I basically stayed in bed.
Well, I'm glad you had fun while you were gallivanting around the country and leave me here editing, slaving over a hot editor.
Yeah, and with really bad audio. So again, apologies to our listeners. Hopefully we have fixed the situation. I believe the situation to be fixed, and it will never, ever happen again.
Hopefully. So I didn't do a lot really interesting last week. I did a fun interview for Mad Art Lab. Maybe I'll talk about that later. But and I edited a podcast and did a lot of work.
Well, you were also on a podcast, weren't you?
I was. Yeah, I guess by the time this comes out, it'll be out. I was on Scruffy Thinking, which I think will come out on Tuesday the 13th or so-ish. With Kanan Flowers. That was fun. I know Kanan. I haven't talked to him in ages. So
right. Yeah, I really enjoy his podcasts. I subscribe to, well, at one point in time, I subscribed to all of them. I think he's only doing two now, which is probably better for his sanity. and certainly easier on my commute, to be honest. It was difficult to keep up with all of them. But he does That Post Show, which is all about post-production video. And he's got fantastic guests. I mean, I think we've talked about this before.
Well, you and I don't think we talked about it on the show, but yeah, or maybe we did.
Maybe he actually seems like a really mellow guy, and everyone I know who knows him in person really likes him. So that's another, you know, plus one for that. So very, very cool. Yeah, hopefully, yeah, he's actually a fellow I didn't get to see while I was in San Francisco that last time, but maybe.
I think you two would get on well.
I think so. I think so. Certainly over beers. Beers help everything, I think.
We'll have to take a Rife road trip to San Francisco.
I fight for the users.
So what makes a good app? One of the things I want to do is talk a little bit about an app versus an application. Now in the post, you know, iOS universe, we've got the concept of the App Store and the Android App Store and all that. And the way I define it is an app is a smaller, cheaper, often mobile application, meaning for a mobile system. Although with the advent of the Mac App Store, obviously we've got them on the desktop now as well. And that's kind of like the scooter, you know, the little mini app, the bite-sized chunk does one thing very well. Very often they are internet connected, what have you. Versus an application, which is something more traditional, more heavy lifting, more functional, possibly more pro. Not to say that an app can't be pro, but it's definitely more of the heavy lifting, more of the truck concept. So like Photoshop, Office, Aperture, Lightroom, that type of stuff. Now that we've got the nomenclature correct, I wanted to sort of get an understanding from you, like, you know, what do you think about the applications that you use on a daily basis? And you know, what do you think makes a really good app or application?
I agree about the we've actually talked about this sideways several times, the delineation between app and application. And I kind of think about the way that Paul Kafasis from Rogue Amoeba does, and although he's talking in a more since as a developer and as his irritations with the App Store, he called the bigger things deep applications. And then these other things are, he called them single feature or, you know, one-offs, which may have been a dig, but I think it's still kind of true. So like, to me, an app is something that does a thing. I mean, you know, Photoshop does a thing, but it does many things to do a thing. You know, it edits images, but it does many things to that image, you know, far more than what I would ever consider in an app.
Well, right. Like, so there's a depth there. People use it for photography. People use it for creating websites.
Right. Like you say, I mean, it's heavy lifting. You don't expect heavy lifting in an app. Even if you have like some sort of image manipulation app, like on your phone or your iPad, you don't expect to have the full breadth of features that you would have in something like Photoshop or even Acorn or something. Maybe Acorn, maybe that's not a good example, but you expect less because it's there to do something quickly. I mean, because, you know, that your mobile device is not something, you don't want to sit down with your phone and spend an hour editing a photo. That's just ridiculous, you know.
And right, exactly. The horsepower isn't necessarily there. But, you know, a lot of the apps that do exist for photo manipulation, I think one of the other things that differentiates between an app and an application in that sense, certainly for photo editing, the ability to get certain looks or certain sort of canned manipulations within one or two clicks.
Right, yeah.
And also being able to share that as well. I think that's a huge thing, certainly with the iOS app universe, where not only did you just take this photograph with your iPhone, you've manipulated it very quickly, and now you're sharing it out to the rest of the world. You know, there's that continuum there that I think is important, which does not exist in the application universe for the most part.
No, I agree. And if you took that app that you just edited the thing on your phone and then you move it to your desktop, you're going to want it to do more and different things once it gets to your depth. Your expectations are going to be very different.
Right, and I think a lot of that has to do with the tools that are available. And I don't mean necessarily the capabilities of the app itself, but rather the tools that you use to manipulate the application. So mouse and keyboard versus fingers and gestures.
Larger screen.
You know, the mouse affords a pixel precision level that you cannot get on an iOS touchscreen because you're manipulating it with your finger. You know, the level of specificity, the resolution is much, much lower. You know, you're dealing with, you know, a 10 by 10 pixel area or more, you know, so we're talking 100 pixels or 300 pixels, whereas, you know, a mouse pointer, the pointer itself is a single pixel. Right. So you have much more precision, which
like
means
typing that,
you know,
with boxing gloves.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not to say that you can't do it. You know, you can zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, but it's just not efficient. You know, and again, a lot of people would slag the iOS apps as being, oh, you know, it's for consumption. It's not really for producing work. And it's and that has been proven wrong time and time again. So, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, I don't want to go down that
road. It depends on the work that you're doing.
You know? Right. But that said, you know, the capabilities of an app are much more shallow. You know, you're not going to get the, you know, the different layerings and the different typography. You're not going to get the depth that you're going to get or precision that you're going to get from a true application. But I think you brought up another really great point, which is apps tend to be one-off or maybe, you know, one-off with a few minor bug fixes. But there's... because they're so inexpensive, there is almost an expectation that the application isn't going to be updated ever, which, you know, isn't necessarily true. But if it were true, it probably wouldn't bother too many people as long as it were, you know, as long as the bug fixes came in.
Right, it's the era of the disposable app.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you use it a few times. It's a buck, you know, or $2 or $5. Even something that's below $10. You know, that's definitely within the realm of a you know, a latte at Starbucks or something. And so I've learned to get over the, oh my goodness, $3 is so expensive. But meanwhile, 4 years ago, I was dropping, you know, $700 on Photoshop without blinking an eye.
Right. Apparently the latte has become the football field equivalent, you know, on television, on the news. If you measure something, it's in football fields.
So right, or Libraries of Congress.
So we measure apps and the price of a latte.
Exactly.
I'm not the only one that does that, right?
Right. No, certainly not. Which is somewhat ironic considering I don't drink lattes. But I do know how much they cost, so because I spend far too much money at Starbucks. So I think there's an expectation there. I'm always surprised at how productive people can be with these simple apps that were made... you know, they were made quickly in relation to a more in-depth application. You know,
for the most part, that's true. Yes.
Right. I mean, the development time is measured in, usually in weeks rather than years. You know, that weeks can be, you know, 52 weeks or so, but usually the development for a, you know, an office suite or what have you, is well over a year. The time it takes to market is just simply much, much longer. You also have larger development crews, right? So the people working on Office, there are hundreds of people working on Office. There is usually one or two or three people working on an app.
Right.
So that also affords some interesting things where with an app, because you've got, you know, maybe it's just you or maybe it's you and, you know, one or two other people, you have a decided vision for your app because it doesn't have to go through, you know, five different levels of management. It doesn't have to appease shareholders or anything like that. It's your vision and it is what you create. In some sense, it can be a more powerful, more compelling application than something more traditional,
right,
at least in terms of user experience.
Right. And you don't really have to go through as much. In most cases, I would say you don't have to sort out whether, you know, the usability is going to be good or bad, because you're following some very basic things. I mean, this is not true for all apps, of course, but you know, especially for like apps targeted at like at iOS on the iPhone. You know, you're working with a small space. You're probably you're working with gestural input from a finger. You know, it's you don't have to sit there and figure out, you know, well, does this bar full of options, you know, is this good? Is it laid out right? So, obviously that's part of the cut down of the time, but it's also a cut down of, like you say, you don't have to spend that, I don't know, that sweat and tears, but also, you know, that development clout. I don't know. I can't think of a good word to say it, but,
you know. Well, right. I mean, it's one of those things where, in my mind, from a developer's perspective and a user experience professional perspective, I often think that the best apps out there are the ones that do one thing and one thing well. It's almost the Unix philosophy, you know, but without the other fun bits of the Unix philosophy, which is, you know, work well with others. iOS apps clearly can't work well with others, although that's changing. That's a good thing. We're now starting to see applications that can register themselves as being able to read certain file types. And so apps can files can hop between one app and another, which is kind of cool. But, you know, the whole Unix philosophy is, you know, do one thing and do it really, really well. And then, you know, talk to other things that can further your pipeline, you know, so you can have text input to one particular application, then output to another application to have it be sorted or what have you, and then finally displayed or munged in another way. And then you've suddenly piped in, you know, four or five different applications all working together through a system of standard in and standard out. I'd like to see more of that in iOS. I don't know if we'll be able to, simply because of this sandboxing that they've got going on. But I think that the future of computing, considering it's going to be a bit more commoditized, more appliance-like, may need more of that, but presented in a safe manner.
Right. Well, we're still in early days of this sort of new computing, so we have to figure out what works first and, you know, what works best. And then hopefully, everyone will adopt a sort of similar concept of how that works. Right. I'm not, you know, saying a standard, but each ecosystem should have some sort of standard. I mean, we'll figure that out as we go along.
I think also the other thing is, at what point in time do we say that the ecosystem is greater than the platform? Meaning that why should I be chained to the iOS when there are other viable platforms available, Windows Phone 7, Android, for example? Hopefully, we'll be able to exchange information, you know, regardless of the platform.
Well, and the thing about it, this is my personal opinion, is that with this move towards, especially on mobile platforms, the disposable app idea, or it's that sort of ethos, you won't really be chained to anything because those same things will be available somewhere else and you won't care. You know, you might still pick the one that you like the best, but what will matter is that I have data X stored in my whatever account somewhere in the cloud and I need to open this file and do something. As long as I can do it across any platform, it doesn't matter what I'm on.
Right. So it really becomes data-centric at that point, which reminds me a little bit about OpenDoc. There were a lot of downsides to that approach. One, at the time, being a memory problem, required massive amounts of memory in order to do properly. And really, it was so different that no one who was a big player at the time was willing to go on board with it. You know, the Adobes were not going to port a bit of Photoshop's engine to this platform that was untested and untried.
Right.
But it was an interesting technology, an interesting concept where, well, you know, your data is in an open format and, you know, anything that could manipulate that format showed itself and you had the opportunity to use whatever tool at your disposal, rather than trap yourself inside a particular tool.
My opinion on OpenDoc is it's akin to that era where everyone was fidgeting with codecs, and there was a billion codecs, and you had to struggle to install the right one, and you know, we started looking for commonality and whatnot, but the thing that worked was the thing that became most popular was the thing that people used. I mean, I think we're back to that now. It's like, well, you know.
Well, we're back to open file formats. We're back to basic things like, and you know, I'm using the term open in a generic way, not in an official OSS,
right.
You know, GNU sort of way. But, you know, JPEGs, TIFFs, WAV files, AIFF files, H.264, these are formats that are not owned by a particular company. Some of the patents or what have you may be owned by a lot of companies. But in general, there's very little barrier to entry with regard to being able to manipulate or read.
Right. And then the applications just have to point at that and go, well, here are the things that people actually use, not what we think they should use. Here are the things that they use. We can read, so we will target that. That's what we will open and read and edit. You know, I mean, and in the end, that's really the way that all things go. It's, I know it's an overdone trope, but you know,
it's an inevitability, isn't it?
Yeah, the Betamax versus VHS. Well, you know, you're going to go with VHS because that's what people have.
You know, that universality sort of gives rise to the era of the native application. You know, the traditional desktop heavyweight application, because the people who used computers were the people who needed to get very specific tasks done. So, you know, they had their desktop machine, they had a screen, you know, everything was in a proprietary file format. We eventually moved a little bit beyond that, and that accelerated with the advent of the web, where people started sharing information, and, you know, HTML being a very open file format. And the objects that were allowed inside an HTML file, or to be referenced in an HTML file, were also relatively open. So that gave us the opportunity to have more applications that deal with more open file formats, which also gives rise to the idea of a web app. So an app that's entirely created via or through HTML technologies. So HTML, CSS, JavaScript. That can be loaded into any browser. And in some cases, especially with something like PhoneGap, for example, for iOS, you can compile your HTML-based application into a quote-unquote native iOS application.
Right.
And there are differences between a native application and an HTML application. And then there's also a difference between a native application that is what I'm calling truly native, which is using Apple's frameworks versus using abstraction layers, which a lot of larger development houses do. Instead of learning Cocoa, instead of learning Objective-C, what they'll do is they'll learn, or rather they'll use the language that they know, which is very often Java, and their compiler will basically translate all of that into native Cocoa code, which never works out very well.
Well, of course.
So,
but, you know, in a way, we have been making apps on the web since the web came about. But
oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, the advent of the CGI bin, but things right. are a bit more sophisticated now.
Right. Now we have a device that we can cater to. I mean, as far as what we call an app, your mobile phone and your iPad and your tablets and your even, you know, down to your smaller laptops or your Chromebook, if you're one of those people. But now it's become something slightly different. And again, you know, we because, you know, at your desktop, you expect so much more, even from your, you know, your web apps. But we now, you know, because we're fully into this, you know, mobile view, desktop view kind of thing.
And I think, yeah, I think that's blurring at a much faster rate than I anticipated, to be honest. Now we have things like responsive design, which is designed to say, hey, remember the whole, one of the major concepts of the web was that you could never really figure out what the viewport was going to be, what the device was going to be. Well, now we really mean it. Because before it was all just basically a desktop. But now we've got not only different screen sizes, but also different capabilities of the device. So, you know, we're talking gesture control, again, gesture control versus mouse control. We're also talking about horsepower, again, where the, you know, the iPhones and such, or just the mobile devices in general, they have a lot more sensors. So we can tap into those, but they have a lot less horsepower. They can't do as much at once. So everything has to be sort of scaled back.
Right.
Based
you can't
upon
pile
that.
On, yeah, you can't pile on some giant Java thing that has to, you know, download and run and, you know, like, that's just not going to go.
Yeah, yeah, it's just going to be a non-starter, which, of course, is why Steve Jobs, you know, hated the idea of Flash on a mobile device because, you know, it hasn't worked on, it hasn't ever been stable on a desktop, let alone on a mobile device. And when you're constrained.
Unless you're a Windows user who has been catered to.
You know what? It hasn't even been stable on Windows. I mean, it's faster on Windows, but it's not stable.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I've been on Windows machines where versions of Photoshop, because the later versions of the Adobe software, the user interface is actually done in Flash. Right. I've had the Flash engine crash on me. whereas the application itself was still running. It didn't realize that the UI crashed. Yeah, once they get rid of that, which I think will probably happen in the next couple of versions, things will go back to normal. But the Windows version of Flash has always been much, much faster and certainly more stable than the Mac version, but it hasn't been stable in an absolute sense, or at least I don't think so. So one of the things, another thing I wanted to bring up was the idea of the human interface guidelines. Apple created for the Macintosh in 1984 timeframe the Apple human interface guidelines, and it was really the first comprehensive guideline for designing an app. No one had dealt with GUIs before, so no one really knew how to create a Mac application, this graphical user interface application. So they created a multi-volume series that dealt with not only the visual elements, but it also dealt with coding standards as well. And that made each Mac application look similar. And right. one of the nice things about that, of course, is that, you know, if every application looks more or less the same, you can pick one up without a lot of retraining or what have you, because you know there are certain elements that are always going to be in the same place. Like everything in the file menu is going to be similar, and everything in the edit menu is going to be similar. They're going to have expanded options, certainly from one application to the next, but they'll always have things like copy, cut, paste, print, save, save as. I guess in Lion there's no more save as, but that's a totally different problem. that's another show.
I think that's a standing on the street corner holding up a book and ranting kind of show.
Yeah, I think I've seen those people in Times Square.
Yeah, holding up the Hague.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Repent, repent.
Or the missing manual, probably.
Yeah. Like the Hague allowed a lot of people to create very elegant applications without having to think too much. I mean, yes, there's obviously they had to concentrate on the application that they were making, but if someone gives you a guideline, you know, you're going to want to follow it because that's something that you don't have to spend too much time thinking about. It's been decided for you.
Right. And you also know that your application is going to fit into this ecosystem. Yeah, you have to figure out how to make this work. People are going to know how to do certain things already. That's going to save you time, yeah, and so forth.
And that was the big fight, you know, when, for example, when Microsoft Word 6 was probably the most notorious. So Word 5.1a was probably the last version of Microsoft Word that was Mac-like. It followed pretty much every Apple convention. It was fast. It was fairly easy to learn. It was robust. It had probably, I mean, it had at the time everything that I needed, certainly, for a word processor.
A lot of people will argue that that was, you know, where it needed to stop. That was,
yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know,
we still argue that.
At some point in time, well, and here's the other thing, though, is that, you know, there are millions of users of Office, and they all maybe only use 20% of the capacity of the application, but that 20% is unique amongst everyone. Part of the reason why applications like Photoshop and Word and all that are so bloated is that there are certain people who really do need to use these particular capabilities. Chances are fairly good that you fall into one of 1,000 niches, and your particular niche has been catered to at one point or another. But yeah, I loved Word 5.1a. It would be interesting to try to run it today.
The other danger, though, is cross-platform applications may have to conform to multiple HIGs, and that generally doesn't work.
Well, that's the question of, like, well, okay, is it more important that your application has a look and feel, and that look and feel is the same across all platforms, or is it more important that your application feels like it's part of the platform that it's on?
Right. Firefox is a prime example.
Mm-hmm.
At various times, it's felt very Mac-like. At various times, it's felt very Windows-like. But, you know, it's varied, but it's the same across platforms for that application, good or bad. Yeah. I have plenty to say about the bad as well as the good, but...
Well, I've always thought that sort of thing is neither fish nor fowl. It's basically the worst of all worlds, right? I mean, and Adobe's, you know, also one of the biggest contributors to that sort of thing, where you know, their interfaces are Adobe's interfaces. They now no longer have any native controls. It's all done in Flash. So,
let me tell you about Adobe rewriting print APIs and doing their own print dialogues, and that stuff's just got to stop.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It just makes it impossible to debug. It makes it impossible to support, even.
Well, I mean, the new Acrobat Reader for the PC users, the first thing we did was when we started, I started getting calls. I can't figure out how to make this print double-sided. So, you know, that just drives me crazy about Adobe.
Yeah, it's another learning curve. It is not Mac-like, it is not Windows-like, it is Adobe-like,
yeah.
which is nice, because, you know, if you are using Adobe products, then it doesn't matter what computer you're using, it's all exactly the same.
Except, though, it's, even in this case, like, it's not. That's the one thing about it. It's like, so it's different between, you know, it's like, all right, so each operating system has a print dialog that's perfectly serviceable, and you've written your own, and they're not the same across the two platforms. Just drives me crazy.
Oh, so Adobe's
they're slightly
written,
different.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, that makes no sense whatsoever. But that's the other thing too. If you're going to write your own stuff, if you're going to write your own UI, you've got to basically write everything that the operating system frameworks would give you for free.
Right.
And very often you're going to code them badly.
Right. So you're going to say, oh, well, I want to have direct file access, and you try to stat some file that, and oh, well, this is on some file system that I've never used before, so we didn't test this, so it works for 80% of the people, but then there's these 20% that we didn't test, and running, you know, with NFS home directories, and guess what? This certain thing doesn't work. We've run into that with Adobe too, like, even as far as like installation. We're digressing, but that's what's important about things like the HIG, even if it's, you know, multiple HIGs. But I think because, well, for one thing, Apple's HIG has informed a lot of the ones that have come since because they've made a lot of the right decisions.
Oh, completely. I still have an old copy of at least some of the volumes of the Apple Human Interface Guidelines on my bookshelf. And the thing that hurts me the most about that situation is that while they have updated the Human Interface Guidelines, Apple themselves do not follow their own Human Interface Guidelines. Which brings up the whole delicious generation rise of skeuomorphism thing. So backing up a bit, Will Shipley, who used to work for Omni Group, who creates OmniGraffle, OmniOutliner, and a whole bunch of other programs all prefixed by the word Omni, decided to leave them and create a company called Delicious Monster. Their product was Delicious Library. And it was one of the first, it was really the first sort of modern era OS X applications that was heavily skeuomorphic and really visually stunning. You wanted to touch it. You wanted to, play with it and use it. Delicious Library started out as a sort of a collection database. So it dealt with CDs, videos, what have you. And its claim to fame not only was its physical beauty, which emulated real shelving and such like that, and also took the images of the cover art and actually put it on virtual CDs and virtual DVDs and such. So it was really, really, really well done.
Right.
And
for people who haven't seen it, if you've seen iBooks, you've basically seen what early Delicious Library looked like.
Apple ripped off a good thing. Right. Ripped off.
I don't want to defend them because I think that's totally where they got it from. But then again, when you move into skeuomorphism, which for people who don't know, is you're making these things look like real things that live in the real world. But the thing about that too is they are real things. So a bookshelf's going to look like a bookshelf.
Right. So there's only so much that you can do. And that really ushered in the era of this new skeuomorphic concept where we're going to disregard a lot of the finer points of the HIG. We're still going to honor the concept of the Human Interface Guidelines, the responsiveness, the...
Now you've just hit on it, though. This is mm-hmm. the birth of, really, of the app.
The other part about skeuomorphism, things looking and feeling like real objects. So we've got things like the linen texture in iOS and Lion, the brushed metal texture in earlier versions of OS X, as well as in some areas in iOS as well. Different metal texture, but the buttons, like the Siri button, for example, it looks like a physical button.
Right.
And I think a skeuomorphic interface works better on a touchscreen rather than on a traditional mouse and keyboard computer.
Right, because you're going back to that.
It's tactile.
Yeah, and you're also using.
It's direct manipulation as well. So, for example, the button, the button that you press that looks like a VCR button, VCR play button, you're pressing it, you're touching it directly, as opposed to the level of abstraction of moving your mouse toward that button and clicking on that button with your mouse.
Right. You're using your metaphors, basically.
Right.
We're back to the Sony Magic Cap, or there's your desk. On your desk is a piece of paper. Well, in a way, we're back to that.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't, it doesn't really work on the desktop, but it totally works on your iPad or your iPhone or your Android phone or whatever.
Yeah, I actually don't mind skeuomorphic interfaces. I think they can certainly be fun. Apps in general, and even applications, should be a joy to use. Even if it's a hardcore, like Final Cut Pro or Logic or what have you.
they can certainly look better than they have, and when they came from their Unix backgrounds and things.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you take a look at color
with gray box with gray lines and some black.
Yeah, if you take a look at Color, not the iOS app, but rather the color grading app that came with Final Cut Studio, that is probably the ugliest interface I've seen on a Mac in a very, very long time. It was pretty clear that Apple didn't do a heck of a lot to change the UI. They just kind of shipped it. They may have changed a few words here and there, but it doesn't conform to anything Apple standard whatsoever. I think it requires a 3-button mouse, which Apple never shipped with. So,
like a lot of these things look they don't now, maybe, but for the longest time, a lot of these apps looked exactly like they did on an SGI or any number of other workstations.
Sure, and they looked bad there as well.
Exactly, because they were hideous, but they were hideous because, well, this is what we have to work with, and this was built by engineers, not by designers.
Right, and I think that's the other problem as well, is that I think more engineers need to learn design and more designers need to learn engineering.
Or at least live very close to one another.
In our office, we've gone through a bit of a metamorphosis where we used to, create websites, and websites of the modern era at the time. They were basically templated pages. You'd have maybe a home page and some other various unique pages, and then you'd have a bunch of pages that were using the same layout but had different content in them.
Right.
And that was... that was due to publishing systems that have become popular. Things like Vignette, things like any sort of CMS that could output HTML. Prior to that, we had, hand-coded each page, not necessarily database-driven.
Yeah,
but now
you would build your site every time you update, and you would go and, all right, we're going to push out another build if you're using templates. So, yeah.
Right.
Totally different.
Yeah, it's a completely different thing. And now we are, now we've made a transition to what is more a rapid application development. I'm hesitant to use the term agile because that has, a very specific dogma associated with it. But it's more agile, it's more iterative than the traditional model, which was, okay, first we're going to do some research into the client. So we've got a discovery phase, then we've got a design phase, then we've got a development phase, and then a deployment phase where, that's the handoff to the client and making sure everything's good to go and doing the QA. Now what we're trying to do is, instead of having our clients deal with static compositions, JPEGs, flat JPEGs, and saying, yes, this is a great design, we're going to go with that, because they need much more interactivity. What we're doing these days is we're actually going from a very basic wireframe almost directly to a prototype. So instead of my wireframes being a deliverable to the client, my wireframes are actually now a deliverable to both the designers and the developers, who come together to create this working prototype. And that prototype doesn't necessarily do everything, but that's the thing that's the deliverable. That's the thing that the client says yes or no on. And,
right.
That way they can see on the device, on a desktop computer or on a mobile device, immediately, those buttons are the right size for the device and they feel right. They're in the right place. All those things are very important, because when you get them wrong, you can easily go back and very quickly change them slightly and then test again. And it's this constant testing. And I think that is certainly improving our products that we deliver. But I think also it allows other application developers and other web application developers to do the same thing.
Right. I mean, yeah, what you're talking about is extreme programming versus agile programming, which is something Ward Cunningham was the father of, I guess. I'm actually old enough. I sat in a class with Ward Ward Cunningham class on extreme programming. I'm so old.
The extreme programming thing and Agile are, you know, they're certainly close cousins, right? So
right.
The whole,
that's what I meant. Yeah, what you're talking about is the iterative testing and the, mm-hmm.
You know, it's very test-driven. It's very like, let's see this on the device as soon as possible. Because if you just see a static comp of something, you know, it may be very beautiful, but if it doesn't work the way you intend it to work, then you're going to create a bad app.
Right.
And you're only going to discover that you're creating a bad app far too long in the chain. And so it's going to be more expensive to change it. And as a matter of fact, I've been in situations where, I really wanted to change a few things that couldn't be changed because of the way the development cycle was being handled. You know, now we've kind of have a better grasp on things, and because we're going toward a more rapid development cycle, a lot of those things are caught earlier. So far, it's worked out fairly well. That is really about managing expectations of the clients and the end users. Specifically, it relating to the commoditization of computing, an audience is no longer consisting of, you know, computer geeks. You know,
right.
Normal people have compute devices.
Right.
You know, they've got their phones.
It used to be the computer geeks and then the people that we computer geeks dictated to how things would work.
Right.
Versus now it's people saying, well, I want this. Your mom, your dad, your little cousin and your nephew. You know, it's no longer is it just the geeks and the people use computers at work and then those other people. Yeah, it's everyone.
And they have entirely different expectations as well. If you give a digital audio workstation software to, you know, an audio designer or a DJ or what have you, they're going to have a certain expectation as to what the capabilities for that application is going to be. They're willing to have a steep learning curve in order to have an almost unlimited access to
we talked about Illustrator.
Right.
There's a steep learning curve for it, but if you need Illustrator, you're going to spend that time. If you don't, stay far away.
If you don't need that, but you still want to have access to this new stuff. You want to have access to something like Path or Stamped or any of the other new things that are out there, any of the other new social networks that are out there. But you don't care what's under the hood. You just want a good, easy experience. We as developers, we need to cater to that. In a very, very big way.
Right. You want your iMovie to look like iMovie does. You don't want it to look like Avid does.
Right, because there's no freaking way that your mom is going to be able to deal with Avid's workflow. You know, whereas...
Unless your mom is an award-winning film editor.
If I had my druthers and I could design... If I could redesign this interface, what would I do? I'd probably change a lot of things. Even just the physical characteristics of the interface, even, you know, without radically changing the functionality, skinning it even would be slightly better because they, you know, in a lot of areas, they're just using, you know, bad font choices or things that are just physically ugly that, right. You know, it makes me not want to use the software.
Right.
You know, you wind up using it begrudgingly. To that end, the interface gets in the way of the content of you trying to work. On some level, you want the interface to disappear so that you can concentrate on the content and you can do what you want to do.
I want to rat hole just for a second
sure.
to tie this podcast with last podcast. Mike Nichol was talking about Final Cut Pro 10 and made the joke, you know, I'm writing my book. It'll be out soon. Chapter 1. About using Final Cut Pro 10, Chapter 1, don't.
Yes.
And then our mutual friend and acquaintance, John Foster, made the actual book, which is 4 chapters, basically 3 chapters. We'll post the link because it's hilarious.
It's hilarious. And it's interactive. So you can actually download the PDF and make your own book, which is fantastic. I highly suggest doing it. It's very Martha Stewart.
Well, one of the things you pointed out, too, mm-hmm. that it was the fact that apps have no manuals, which I really had not thought about. You know, it's like one of those things you know, but you don't ever think about.
Remember when Photoshop came with its own 500-page manual? It was fantastic. They did a really great job creating printed manuals. Of course, those were 8,000 tons and, you know, cost a huge amount in shipping. And then, right. You know, optical media came out. So then we were able to have electronic manuals on, in CD-ROM form, which is also great in PDF form or what have you, which is also really fantastic because now you could search for something that you wanted, which was lovely. Right. But one of the weird things now is that not only do apps not have manuals and they're not expected to have manuals, they should be, you know, you should be able to pick them up, see pretty much instantaneously how they work and be up and running within seconds. But even the larger applications, they don't come with manuals anymore. It's very, very weird. Some of them have online help, but that's not the same thing. And right. It's a big problem. One of the stalwarts actually of old school applicationdom, and one of my favorite applications of all time, BBEdit, they have a tremendous online manual, a full manual that is, it just goes so in depth.
You know, I've had users lament this to me, and they're like, "Well, I buy this thing, but nobody makes manuals anymore." But it occurs to me that there could be a flip side to this too is, and there's, you know, there's a cottage industry of people writing manuals or books third party about things.
Right. I mean, and O'Reilly exists pretty much because manuals aren't very good.
Right. But when O'Reilly starts doing a really good book, I mean, I imagine some of these companies are going, "Well, we're not going to make a book as good as O'Reilly, so let's not make one at all."
Right. Seems to me pretty clear that O'Reilly, when they do make a book on a particular application, they do talk to the creators of that application and communicate with them fairly closely in order to come out with the book. So there is that. So really what they've done is they've outsourced manual creation to third parties. For example, lynda.com is a great resource for that sort of thing. Right. You know, they'll go pretty in depth, and it's also super cheap too. Not to plug lynda.com because they're not a sponsor and I've not received any money for them. And also just straight up YouTube, you know, there's always someone doing a demo of something or other and describing exactly how they're doing it. So that helps a lot as well.
Like Bert Monroy has his show, and there's another one on, there's all kinds of stuff out there.
And there's also,
I mean, I think that's kind of a morphing that part, that aspect of the applications and apps. Apps shouldn't need a manual, and applications might not give you a manual because they know you're going to get it elsewhere.
I did a series of screencasts for OmniGraffle Pro, and I did that because it's the tool that I most often use in my professional career. A lot of other information architects and user experience designers use it as well, but they're not necessarily proficient in it. They don't realize that the tool itself is actually much, much deeper than merely being able to put boxes and arrows onto a canvas. You know, it was creating these podcasts so that people would sort of get an understanding about that. Speaking of which, I'll have to create more of those.
But again, in a way, that still kind of speaks to the, you know, why make a manual? Especially if there are things that are geared towards, you know, if you're doing this, do this, versus here's how this tool works. Like, for instance, I did the same thing for, I run a comics in Australia. It's a forums and it's a site and whatnot. And I did like some basic tutorials on, you know, using Photoshop to do your comics, because I saw all these people out there that were, they didn't understand how to use layers properly. And they were, you know, they were trying to fill their line art, you know, like, which is, of course, is anti-aliased and it never fills. And they're like, "Why do I have all this white around my lines?" You know, so just a basic thing is like, here's how you do a multiply layer for your, you know, your line art. And here's how you fill your flats underneath, blah, blah, blah. Very simple thing. But it was like, it was a niche thing and not going to be, it's going to be in a manual, but it's not going to explain, you know, that if you're making a comic, this is what you should do.
Well, it's task-based versus function-based.
Right. Right. So in a way, we're filling that, we and the entire internet are filling that bucket that used to be a manual, but that bucket's enormous now.
Do you have any favorite applications or apps that you're using?
Oh, well, Alfred is one of my favorites. I mean, that's just something that I use average free, but then you have these packs you can add on for different things. So it's really kind of neat. I like the whole idea of it. Trying to think about this earlier, but I would say Alfred Transmit and Text Wrangler. Now, I have a reason for saying Text Wrangler instead of BB Edit. So, like, on my machine at work, let's say, for instance, I'll have Alfred, but I'll have Transmit and Text Wrangler. I know that I can drop Text Wrangler on, you know, any machine, which is really nice, and it's there. If any machine I need to, like, so I have a couple of development servers that I rarely have to log into, but when I do, it's nice to have Text Wrangler there, you know, it's free, whatnot.
Right. So,
and well, yeah, I mean, BB Edit, it's a very big truck.
But
if you need a big truck, you should look at BB Edit.
And the neat part,
especially if you do multiple things.
Right. Well, the neat part about BB Edit, though, is that yes, it's technically a big truck, but it's stealth because it's just a text editor.
It's a very nice truck.
Yeah, but the idea though is that it's a text editor. You open it up, and it's effectively a plain sheet of paper, and you can write on it. You know, there's no special command like Vi where you need to, you know, hit the I button to start inserting text. You just type normally, like any other text editor would. But as your needs increase, BB Edit is right along with you. My favorite app on iOS probably is still, or at least the one I use the most certainly is probably Instagram. I've got my vintage, antique, original iPhone. The fairly easy to use, simple. You know, take a picture, you know, click a button, you know, take a look at, you know, some sort of predefined look, and then instantly upload that to Flickr and to Twitter, I think is brilliant.
I just use the standard camera app now, though, because they can do all that, basically, except for the looks, but I don't ever do that anyway. So.
Right. I'm stuck on 313.
Right, right.
And so it doesn't have any cropping or rotating or anything like that. So I need to have a third-party application in order to do anything, you know, rather than take just a full-frame picture. Cool.
I was going to mention one more thing that another app / application. Well, it's an app, but man, I still just love HBO Go. Let me tell you what.
Yeah.
And the TiVo remote app, because I've had a TiVo Premiere sitting on my floor for like a month. I finally got it hooked up today and they came out and repaired the cable card, and using the TiVo remote app with the Premiere it's so awesome.
Another app that I really like is, it's actually of Japanese origin. I forget exactly who makes it, but it appears on my iPhone as Stopwatch. And it's I'll definitely put the link in the show notes, but it is possibly the most beautiful stopwatch timer I've ever seen in my entire life. It works in both portrait mode and in landscape, and it will do split times, it will do countdown timing, all sorts of other fun stuff. It's really beautiful, and if I recall correctly, it's either free or very, very cheap. But
check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out. It's really quite beautiful. So, I
Can
guess
I plug
that's
one
it.
More?
Oh yeah, of course.
I just thought when you said that was a very beautiful app. I have a very ugly app. It is. It's hideous. It's when you start it up, it looks like a view of the Windows Explorer back in the Windows 95 days with the yellow folders.
Oh, right.
It's called Go Figure or Go Figure Lite, but it's incredibly simple. All it does is has a bunch of conversions for like health, cooking, science, money, shopping, finance, and dining out. I use it all the time because I'm horrible at math. So like tipping, whether you have a table full of people, there's a thing for that.
Okay, here's how tips work.
I know how it works.
You take 10%, which is merely moving the decimal place, and then doubling that.
And then you have seven people.
Yes, but you just take what they owe.
Yeah.
And then
what you do is you open this program and you put in 84.64. We're going to tip 20%. There are seven people. Everybody owes $14.51. Thank you. Let's go home now.
Oh, that does work. That also works. But then again, who's gonna pop in change? Are people really gonna pop in change?
Who cares?
Yeah,
as long as, like, when I get asked to do math, that's when I panic.
Right. Well, also, yeah, I mean, why, especially when you've got something like, you know, a calculator in your pocket, why would you try to do maths in your head when you can just type it in and be done with it? As long as you've got the formulas at your ready, you're good to go. So where can we find you again?
Where can you find me? You can find me at maggiemcphee.com, or you can find all about me at about.me/maggiemcphee. And also at my webcomic, sacremu.com.
Sacremu.
Sacremu. Which I update periodically.
I saw your last one. I really liked the shading in your Batman. I thought that was fantastic.
I love doing the Batman ones. I don't know why. It's just fun to make fun of Batman.
Nice. It's just,
I'm also at a site called Mad Art Lab, and I told you I just interviewed George Sanger, aka the Fat Man, who's like a legend in video game music. Man, it was so much fun. So, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me at localtype.org. And on here, you could also find me on Twitter at Octothorpe. That's OCTOTHORPE, as in the hash or pound or number sign.
Wow.
So we'll be back next week, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts, Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
Christopher, honey,
yeah.
Show me on the UI where Flash touched you.